Torch Trust, Sightloss 101, in conversation with Philippa Lomas.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Sightloss 101, where I, Tim Jeffrey, the Chief Exec of Torch Trust, have conversations with people who are blind or partially sighted, as part of helping me to understand, as a sighted person, what's it like to live in their world. Today, I have a great pleasure of talking to Philippa Lomas. And Philippa is somebody who has, I understand, been blind from birth. Philippa, welcome. And it would be lovely just to hear a little bit about your story and how your life has kind of unfolded thus far and how sight loss has featured in that.
Yeah, no worries. So I was born blind with a condition called bilateral anophthalmia, which basically means that my eyes didn't develop in the womb. So I have plastic eyes. And obviously that was a massive shock to my parents. They got six other children. And my mum, all the way through the pregnancy, knew that something was wrong, but everything on the scans was clear and they couldn't understand why she felt like that. So, you know, basically when I was eventually born, they kind of had to back down and say, no, you were right, there was something wrong. So it was a huge shock, but they really wondered how I was going to live a normal life. And they're very strong Christians. They always sent us to Sunday school. They have a very, very strong faith, and they were really wondering what God would bring out of this situation, you know, how he would how we would make it good. But they fought for me to be sent to mainstream school. They treated me just like they did any of their other children. So I played with my brothers and sisters, you know, I was responsible for things around the house, you know, little jobs like you are when you're young.
And what number were you in the kind of the?
I was the baby.
You were number six, were you?
Yeah, oh no, I was number seven.
Oh, number seven. Okay.
Yeah, no, I have four sisters and two brothers.
Wow.
So yeah, they were a very noisy household, but it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. You must have been, as well as kind of being the baby one that they all looked after, I suppose, with the sight loss as well, that must have added an extra sort of protective layer to how they engaged with you.
It did, but also they very much treated me like one of them, you know, very much normally, and didn't let it stand in the way, you know. If they were riding bikes, I rode my trike along with them, you know, around the garden, things like that. Things like, you know, when we were playing, we used to be very naughty, and we used to get in sleeping bags and slide down the stairs because the front door was directly in front of the stairs. So we used to be able to slide right out the front door if we got a good enough, you know, run up, you know, good enough momentum. We used to, and you know, I did that along with them. They didn't sort Brilliant. Of, it wasn't, oh, you know, she can't do this, she can't do that because she can't see. There were things they did slightly differently, like they would bring me things to feel, they would show me things, they would for quite a long time they always said, so my brother Ben would say, well, Ben's just going to go and do this, and that was because I needed to get to know them and their voices and who they were.
Yeah,
you know, so saying the name in the sentence, yeah. You know, gave me that ability to learn who they were, really. So, you know, it was just, I would say I had a very, very normal childhood. And certainly because I went to mainstream school.
Yeah.
Although I didn't go to after lower school, because we're in a three-tier system. So after lower school, I didn't go to the same school as my siblings. I did still go to mainstream school. So I went to the school that had a blind child before, and then I went to a more local school after that for my GCSEs and things. But, you know, it still meant that I went through the same sort of things as they did.
Yeah. And how was school for you? I mean, that's wonderful. You managed to stay in mainstream school. How well did they differentiate for you?
Lower school was fine. I had always had a team with me, so they taught me to read Braille at age five when other children are learning to read print. Wow. I was very reluctant to learn Braille. To me, it was really boring. And it was just a load of dots with nothing to break it up, really. And I think I really struggled with that because I wasn't interested. But I learned to touch type at the age of six. And again, that was a skill. I was just like, why are they teaching me this?
Wow.
But now, you're looking back, Braille and touch typing are the things that I really couldn't do without, you know, and the things from my education that I use every day. So, but you know, after lower school, it got a bit harder because the workload was harder. The children weren't children from my local village. They were from, you know, quite a big town near us called Bedford. And you know, it was just different. I went from a school with probably about 50 children max to a school with sort of 250 children, you know. It's just it was a big jump. And then from that to go to a school that's probably got, I think it was about 600 pupils, you know, it's massive. And the school premises were massive, and I found it it's difficult to get my way around. I could do it, but I was very self-conscious. I didn't really want to be the one that stuck out. I didn't want to get lost. I didn't, you know, so that sort of aspect was difficult for me. And the fact that teachers really didn't understand that they needed to give the work to my support team in advance for it to be brailled. So I'd get to sort of a science lesson, and there'd be a worksheet with a diagram that hadn't been produced in a tactile format because the teacher hadn't given it in time. And then I'd get told that I wasn't putting the effort in. And I sort of say to the teacher, well, how do you expect me? I actually asked her once, I said, how do you expect me to put the effort in when you don't put the effort in? She was like, well, that's a fair enough question, actually.
Really?
So I actually did find it really hard work, especially GCSEs. I didn't particularly enjoy school. I did all right in my subjects apart from maths and science, but I didn't particularly enjoy it. But I mean, there was teachers that made it better, like my art teacher. She I took GCSE art because she was all about making it work for me. So, you know, I'd have different mediums to work with, like plaster of Paris or paint with stuff mixed in it or shiny paper or, you know, whatever. It was all about textures, you know, and things that worked for me. So in fact, she pulled me out of a class once because the teacher he was teaching the class was doing reflections, and she was like, this is absolutely ridiculous. How on earth do you expect a blind person to sit there and talk about reflections, you know, in a mirror, just and paint the picture from the reflection in the mirror? She's just like, no, this is wrong.
Amazing that just, it strikes me, the kind of creativity that some people bring, thinking about how do I make this work for somebody who has got, you know, got either a visual impairment or some other, you know, disabling condition, and how the creativity that people come with. That sounds wonderful. That art teacher's,
she was amazing. Absolutely.
Yeah,
she was brilliant.
It's a real lesson, isn't it, for the rest of us, I guess.
Yeah.
How do we, you know, let's really use our sort of God-given creativity to find ways of making things work.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very much about people's attitudes and willingness to think outside the box.
Yeah.
And if, you know, if they're not willing to sort of think about it, if they just think, oh, well, this won't work, or I'm not going to do anything different, you know, I don't know what to do that could be different, it's not going to work. Because, you know, I had teachers like that who would just say, well, that's what your support team are there for. But it wasn't, you know, they can't read me every aspect of the lesson. There needs to be sort of some communication beforehand. So I really did struggle in school in a lot of ways, but I'm glad I went to mainstream school.
Yeah,
I think for me, I'm not saying this is the case for absolutely everybody, but for me, I think had I have gone to a school for the blind, a residential school, I would have missed out on family life. I would have not really had a clue how hard I would find it when I came out, because, you know, the working world is not much different.
Yeah. Can I ask you a very practical question, Philippa? And that is, you know, I'm just kind of putting myself in your shoes and thinking, going from a small school to a big school, a new building with lots of rooms and corridors and outside spaces, how do you do that when you're blind? I mean, do you sort of build a map of it? Do you get somebody to guide you round? How does that work for you?
So a bit of both. So the mobility teacher or rehab worker, as they're now called, will come in and they will find out which classrooms you need access to. Mm-hmm. And then they will take their arm, walk through the corridors. They'll point out various landmarks. So it could be, right, this corridor has a glass door, this corridor has a wooden door, you know, or there's a jutting out piece of wall here. And when you get to that, you know, you need to turn down the next corridor, you know, things like that. Well, there's a piece of carpet here. When you get to that carpet, you need to go straight ahead to the next door and point out the landmarks and then walk it through with me using my long cane.
And so you create a map in your head of...
That's how you do it. You build it up.
Right.
And eventually sort of get to remember your routes.
Yeah.
But it took me... I mean, it was fine when the corridors were empty, but I used to absolutely hate it when sort of, 50 children were coming the other way.
I can imagine.
They used to let me leave a little bit early from lessons.
Okay.
So that I could actually, you know, just... try and make it rush to my next class before the rush.
Thank you. I was just fascinating to know, you know, I have my family say that I have got an internal sat nav because I just seem to know which direction I'm facing, and so it makes me think, how, you know, when you have a new building or you go into a new church or something, or new home, how do you do that? How do you create that kind of internal map?
Well, for me, it was all right inside, but I didn't like things like taking buses, going on public transport.
Yeah.
You know, I was very, like I said, I was very self-conscious and I was very scared of becoming lost with no one to help me. And of course, back in those days, we didn't have mobile phones all the time and things like that. And that was, I was very conscious of that, which made me really, really wary of doing routes in my hometown.
Yeah.
And things like that. And because we lived in a village, I would have had to have got on a bus to go into town. And the problem with the buses around here is that if they don't see you waiting at the stop, they won't stop the bus.
Yeah.
They won't just stop and wait. So if I wasn't standing in the correct place, the bus, you know, could have driven past. Or sometimes they'd think, well, I'm not going to drive down to that stop because there's no one waiting, so I'll stop at the stop before. And, you know, it's just... that uncertainty made me really panicky and unwilling to sort of break out of the box. I'd rather sort of go, you know, and I had a couple of bad experiences in shops when I went and tried to ask for help. So it really put me off. It wasn't till later on when I had my children and, you know, moved into my own house, had my children, needed to walk around my local town, needed to take them to school. But I've always been taught, you see, that, or not always been taught, but always been told by the blind community that independence is getting on public transport. And because I couldn't do that, you know, but my argument was, well, actually, now I've moved, I live right over the road from the shops.
Yeah.
You know, I live walking distance from the school.
Brilliant.
It's all going to be on foot. It's all something I can do. So now that's happened. I'm a lot more travel independent.
Yeah, fantastic. And so, sorry, I interrupted your fascinating story. So what happened after school?
So after school, I did stay on and do my A-levels, which I actually wish I hadn't done because of the extra stress. Mm. But after that, before I left, the headmistress asked the school reception to give me 6 months' experience on the switchboard. So that was really good. I learned a lot there, and then I went and tried to apply for jobs and things like that, and various knockbacks, like being told, well, you're a health and safety risk, so you can't really come and work here. I volunteered for hospital radio, but it was kind of like, well, we've got to get someone to lead you around, so that wouldn't be practical, things like that. Various knockbacks and kind of sort of was wondering really what God wanted out of my life. And maybe that I just need to be, because I've got loads of nieces and nephews, maybe I just need to be a babysitter, you know, for them. And then my uncle, who owns auction centre in Bedford, he rang me and he said, I'm looking for somebody to come and do a couple of days' work answering the phones while the others are typing up the lots for auction. So I was like, well, yeah, I am interested. So I went and found out about that. And I actually worked there for 3 years. With support from Access to Work, and really, really learned a lot there. And eventually sort of got, as well as answering the phone, I got able to type the lots on for sale, you know, and help with the cataloguing and things like that. So that, I really enjoyed that job. And it was brought to a bit of an abrupt end, because Access to Work, which is the company that funds all the specialist equipment and things, they had done my claim for 3 years, and because I had taxis to and from work, because I was working part-time, it should have only been for 1 year. So they did it wrong. And then when I came to the end of the claim, it was like, well, we're not going to renew it because, you know, you're not supposed to have any more support for 12 months. So I basically lost my job overnight, because I couldn't pay the taxi costs to get to and from work. So that was a bit of a shock. Like, you know, it was kind of God sort of saying, well, that job's come to an end, you know. But like, to go back a bit, I was always very much aware that God existed, and I remember from a really young age talking to him and asking him to forgive me right from sort of when I was in lower school. I very much remember having conversations with God, and I went to the Sunday school in my local church in Potton, which was where my family attended, and that church were absolutely fantastic. They were really inclusive and still are. And the pastor's wife at the time, she learnt Braille along with my parents so that she could Braille out hymns or Sunday school lessons for me. Yeah, it was really good.
What a commitment.
I know, it was brilliant. So I was, you know, always really involved in church.
And church leaders, take note of that one.
Yeah, absolutely. It was brilliant. It was really good. And people would, like the teachers of the Sunday school, they would make things like, for example, we did once the story of the woman of washing Jesus's feet with her tears and, you know, pouring oil on them. And I had a pair of cardboard feet and a bottle of perfume, you know, and it was just accessible, really, really nice. So I'd always been really involved in church, and because I'm quite fairly musical, and I do a bit of singing, so I was singing in church and things. So I'd come to know God at an early age, and I was baptized at 12.
What difference do you think being a Christian has made in your life, and particularly as a blind person, in terms of coming to terms with that, with dealing with that every day? What's the difference it's made?
A massive difference. I really think, had I have not been blind, I wouldn't have relied so heavily on God. And I know that the first face that I will ever see is going to be the face of Jesus. And that to me is so important. I mean, throughout my life, there's been so many times when everything's changed and everything's been uncertain. And I've really taken comfort from the fact that God never changes. You know, and he's always the same. And that really, really helped. I mean, you know, people have asked me why I haven't got enough faith to be healed. But it's not actually about that. It's about the fact that God wants to bring something about from me being blind, rather than, yes, it would be a massive miracle for him to heal me, and he could do it right now, but that's not what is in his plan. His plan is to use me as I am to reach out to other people. And that's really how I got involved with Through the Roof. I went on a trip with them to Guatemala.
Wow.
I was there. Their ambassador out there to say that basically people with disabilities should be included and shouldn't be ostracized just because they've got disabilities. And that was voluntary. And that came about because I'd had a really bad relationship, and it had really knocked my faith and my trust in God. And I'd sort of come back to God and said to him, what do you want me to do for you? Because I really want to do something for you. Now that I have come back to you. And my church had actually just changed their hymn books, and they had swapped the hymn books to praise and Christian hymns, and Christian hymns wasn't available in Braille. So they sort of said to Torch Trust, how much would it cost to transcribe? And I think the cost was about £1,000. And the church funded that. So that, you know, it was
fantastic.
You know, yeah, and it was around about the time that the Baptist Times were doing some articles on Braille in churches, and so I got interviewed for one of those, and from that the CEO of Through the Roof saw my article and sort of got in touch and said, would you like to come on a mission trip? So that was amazing, and I can honestly say it's one of those times in my life when it's just been, I knew that God was sending me and I knew that I should go, and he was there almost close enough to touch, you know, and I just, it was amazing. And I went three times. Ten days each year for 3 years. And then, so that was, and I was still working at my job at Peacock's Auction Centre. And then in, I think it was 2011, when my job ended, it was like, you know, what do I do now? And then the opening for a youth ambassador came up at Through the Roof for, as a paid job. So which I applied for, and I got that job, and I worked there for 3 years. During that time, I was going around churches basically doing what I'm doing now, and sharing my story, and trying to show that just because, you know, people in your churches have disabilities, or people in your family have disabilities, there is a place for them in the church, there is a place for them in life, there's a place for them in school, you know. It's all about adapting, you know, your attitudes, your way of working. You can include these people. They can bring valuable contributions to, you know, to everyday life and to church life. And I did that for 3 years. And during that time, went to Guatemala for the third time. And then while I was working with Through the Roof in 2012, I was asked to go on a torch holiday and share my story. So I was like, I was going to do it for one day. And then I decided, well, I actually might go on the holiday because, you know, it looks quite fun. So I said to my mum, she's like, oh, you never know. I was like, no, if you think I'm going on this holiday to meet someone, I'm not going. Okay. I'm not going. So I went on this holiday, and there was this man there, like, called Will, who had not really much time for God, been brought up Catholic, and it's fine, he's sitting opposite me, he can hear every word I'm saying, so it's all good. been brought up Catholic, and not gone to church for a long time, and then come on the holiday because it was an adventure holiday, and was brought to know the Lord during that holiday. And we came back a courting couple, basically, and were married in 2013.
Wow.
So, and we have two children. So.
And tell us, Philippa, how has it been being blind and being a parent? How do you manage that? I mean, I think of, you know, my own experience of parenting and all the challenges that there are, and trying then to think of that, you know, without sight is just, well, amazing. So I'd just love to know, what have been some of the challenges? What are some of the sort of the ways actually in which, you know, you've managed to make it work really well?
So I've always been around children. So I've got loads of nieces and nephews. I think the last count, I've got 20, 7 nieces and nephews, and like of 6 great nieces and nephews. So I've always been around children, and I knew that I could look after a baby, and it was like, it was basically about proving it to other people. But I mean, I had my mum and dad's full support, you know, and the first 6 weeks obviously were very, very hard, like they are for any new parent. Because although, you know how to look after children, when it's your own, and you're solely responsible for this little person, it's totally different. Whereas when you can give them back, you know, it's, you're not sort of like responsible for the final, you know, the final happenings of the day, if you like. So the buck doesn't stop with you, really, I suppose, basically.
There's always a fallback to pass them back to.
Exactly, yeah. So when I had Caris in 2014, I, for various reasons, struggled to feed her, and, you know, sort of learned a lot through that, not because I couldn't, it wasn't anything to do with not being able to see, but because of a medical condition, I couldn't breastfeed her the way I wanted to. Which really upset me, because then I had to learn how to make out bottles and things like that. But I, you know, instead of using a buggy, I would use a sling, which kept her close. It meant I had two hands to do housework, or to use one hand with my cane and, you know, and walk around with her. So I used the sling a lot. When she got to walking, I used bells. I put bells on the back of her dress, and squeaky shoes. So I knew where she was, but she was always very, very vocal and very good at telling me where she was. And if she wanted to show me something, she'd grab my hand and she'd pull me to it. So she learned from a very young age to, you know, to be really adaptable. And it, if I took a buggy out, I would take a buggy that I could pull. So I would be pulling the buggy with one hand and using the cane with the other. It was, you know, it has its challenges, but I think it has a few more challenges than sighted people do, but I think they're just, you just have to think of different ways around them. And, you know, obviously we can change nappies, we can prepare bottles, we can breastfeed, we can feed, you know, we can feed, you know, solids, spoon feed, and take the baby out for a walk. It's all doable, and very much so. It's just finding different ways of doing that. But I did encounter, you know, I remember distinctly once I'd got Caris out of the bath and the health visitor was due. I just dressed her and the health visitor came in and she was like, oh, I need to weigh her. And I was like, right, okay. She said, have you bathed her all by yourself? I was like, yeah, actually. And it was just like, they were so shocked that my mummy wasn't there, you know, holding my hand. But I think it taught them a lot. It taught us, certainly, I mean, my health visitor, from being a little bit unsure and, you know, not knowing what, you know, how I would cope, after that, became very, very supportive and really, really brilliant. So, you know, it's a learning curve for professionals as much as, And there were things that I really struggled with, like when they were first walking and wanting to walk along the road. It was things like, how do I know where they are? So we had things like wrist straps or harnesses that, you know, that had a strap on, so that I can actually hold onto the strap rather than keep holding onto the handle, you know, and things like that. And you know, I would say that really the challenges started when it was time for them to learn to write their names and things like that. That would be my sort of, you know, take on it. Because things like spoon feeding, like with Caris, I did a mixture of both, a spoon and baby-led weaning. So I used to spoon feed her, and she got to the stage where she would either lean towards the spoon, or she would take my hand and guide my hand to her mouth. So she did that from a very young age. But I used to sort of touch her cheek and then put the spoon to her mouth. But I mean, it just, you know, it just makes a bit more mess. It does get the job done, you know. So there's definitely,
not going hungry.
Yeah, no, exactly. But I mean, it's a challenge. I mean, what I used to panic about was whether I'd cleaned her face before I took her out, you know, or if I'd got a feeder in public, would everybody sort of say, oh, that person's making a right mess, you know, that poor child. But, you know, it was, again, it's like when I, because I went to a toddler group, and it was a learning curve for them as well as me, you know, it was very much. But, you know, thoroughly enjoyed it, really, those early days. And obviously now I've got two. So I used to, people have double buggies, don't they, normally? But I used to double carry. So I had one on the back and one on the front. I must have walked around. Yeah, I must have looked like a three-headed monster, but, you know. it was just easier because then I had my other hand free. Yeah. And then, you know, I mean, I could take a buggy, but it was much easier just to take the sling. Yeah. And, you know, you just adapt and learn. It's a learning curve. And now I actually volunteer for an organisation called Blind Parents UK. And we teach, we don't teach people to look after their children. That's the wrong way to say it. But we give like Zoom sessions on birth and early days, and we have a sling consultant so that she can teach them how to tie their slings independently.
And provide the website. That's Blind Parents UK. Is there a website?
Yeah, Blind Parents UK. Blindparents.uk is blindparents.uk. We were originally Blind Mums Connect, but we've just changed our name to Blind Parents UK. And we have, like, we give feeding advice, we give buggy advice, so like the best buggies that are pullable. Mm-hmm. And we're really about peer support. So people that have been in the same position as someone else, and we've got a very active Facebook group and a very active community, quite a few expertise sort of, you know, in various different areas, which so at the moment, because I'm now a fully trained breastfeeding counsellor, I do all the feeding support and early days stuff, as well as the buggy things.
That's amazing. It's so good to hear about that and the creativity and things available. I've got one last question for you, and it's asking you for a top tip. So out of your experience, for me as a sighted person and other sighted folk who are watching this, what would your top tip be to us about how best to engage with folks who are blind or partially sighted? What's the most helpful thing we can do or be as we engage together?
I think treat us as you would treat anyone else. You know, there's only a few things that you need to sort of change. So if you're speaking to a blind person for the first time, then if you know their name, say their name so that no, they're talking, you know, you're talking to them. So quite often I get this on the school run that somebody will say good morning, and I'm never sure whether they're saying it to me or, you know, to the person that's walking down the other side of the road. So, you know, if you know their name, then say it. If not, you know, make them aware that you're talking to them, maybe a light touch or something like that, and just be normal. Don't ever assume that just because we can't see at all or can't see properly that we won't have a very full active life and be able to you know, cope with things the same way sighted people will, and we basically want to be treated the same as everybody else. There are going to be a few exceptions, there are going to be a few adaptations needed, but basically just be yourself and let them be their selves. It's like when I do because I'm the main administrator now for our church, so I will contact all the preachers and things like that, and by my emails they don't even, you know, if they don't know me, they don't know that I'm blind. You know, it's not until they come to church, because it's irrelevant. You know, in a lot of ways it's just that I contact them for the information, or I contact them to make sure they're still okay to come and things like that. So, you know, it's a level playing field, and it's, you know, it's just about being who we are as people and letting us grow in that way that God wants us to.
Absolutely. Philippa, that has been absolutely wonderful. You have made my day. It's been really lovely to speak with you and to hear your story. And it's incredibly inspiring. So thank you so much for sharing with us.
No worries.
Thank you for joining us on Sight Loss 101. For more information on Torch, call 01858 438 260.